Wisdom has been a philosophical and religious concept for many years, but we have focused on wisdom as a scientific construct and shown that it is based in specific parts of the brain. We can measure it, and yes, anybody and everybody can become wiser.
Hello and welcome to the podcast, 10 Lessons It Took Me 50 Years to Learn, where we dispense wisdom for your career and your life. My name is Duff Watkins and I'm your host. Our guest today is Dilip Jess, neuropsychiatrist, expert in aging, and also an expert on wisdom. It was just a few weeks ago I was strolling down the beach here in Brazil and listening to the audiobook of Wiser, The Scientific Roots of Wisdom, and I thought, we got to get this guy on the show, and now we are. Welcome to the show, Dilip.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be on your show, Doug.
Well, it's our pleasure. So let me tell listeners about Dr. Jess and his background. He is the author of 14 books. He has published over 625 scientific research articles. And about those articles, they are some of the most cited and quoted in the world. Dr. Jess is in the top 0.5% of publishing researchers, which makes him one of the world's most cited authors. Now, let me explain that, listeners. In the world of science and in medicine, you write stuff, it has to be recognized, it has to be appreciated, it has to be quoted, cited, and basically it's a massive form of peer approval. And that's what we're talking about. But wait, there's more. Dr. Jess is also listed in the best doctors in America. He's won way too many awards for us to mention on this show, so we'll just get stuck right into your wisdom. Or actually, let me see if I can do a one-sentence summary of your book, Wiser, The Scientific Roots of Wisdom, which you wrote with Scott Laffey. Both of you, you were a professor at the University of California at San Diego, and Scott works there as well. And my one sentence summary of the book Wiser would be, wisdom is biological. It can be measured, studied, and enhanced. How'd I do?
You did it absolutely perfectly. You hit the nail on its head. Thank you, Doug.
It's a very interesting book. It's well worth reading. And so once again, Wiser, The Scientific Roots of Wisdom. But today we want to talk about personal wisdom, the things that you've acquired in your life. Now, you come from a small town in India, and it seems like very early on you decided you wanted to be a psychiatrist. Now, at the time, there's about 550 million people in India. There were maybe 100 psychiatrists in the whole country. And you didn't want to be an engineer like everybody else. You didn't want to be just a doctor. How did you latch onto psychiatry?
Yeah. So when I was a teenager, I loved reading books. I was a bookworm. And the books I loved most were Sigmund Freud's Interpretation of Dreams and Everyday Errors of Life. What Freud did was he would take a dream or a slip of tongue and then use the clues from the person's behavior and personality to interpret those. And Freud was a neuropsychiatrist. And although he was a father of psychoanalysis, he believed that psychology rode on the back of physiology. So he believed that actually there was a basis in the brain for all these different things. And I thought that was just so fascinating that I decided that I needed and wanted to study brain and mind. And so my goal was to do research in that. And so the first step, of course, was to become a psychiatrist. So I went to medical school in order to become a psychiatrist. And I'm sure many of my friends questioned my sanity, why I would want to do that. But after doing my training there, I said that I really want to do research on that. And the mecca of research in medicine, including psychiatry, is the National Institutes of Health in the U.S. And so that's where my wife and I decided to migrate to the U.S.
And you've been there for a very long time. And I believe your wife is also a psychiatrist for children?
Yes, she's a child psychiatrist. And so I learned a lot from her about childhood and how to bring up kids. And we have two daughters, and they're also doing very well. Thank you.
Well, your first lesson, number one, I have to say, Dilip, I was very discouraged by this. It rocked my world. Lesson number one is, if you think you're wise, you're not.
Yes. Actually, that's something that have been known for quite some time. Socrates, one of the first philosophers to talk about wisdom, he famously said, the only true wisdom is knowing you know nothing. And I can actually relate to that. When I started doing research as a young scientist, I would begin research on a given topic by doing some quick literature review and then doing some small pilot study. At the end of that, I thought I knew the field very well. I knew the entire literature. I knew what the science was like. And slowly but surely, I understood how unwise that was, that there was so much more to know, that I was really not even close to getting what was needed. And that time I read something that Isaac Newton had said. He said that what we know is a drop. What we don't know is an ocean. And I've increasingly realized that the more I knew about something, the less I knew about it, because I realized how much there was to know. And that what actually is wisdom, that there are times when we do something and we think we acted very wisely, and that's why we are wise. And slowly but surely, it turns out that that's not the case. And we also need to keep that in mind about other people. Sometimes there are people who seem to be very confident and they claim to be wise, and one may fall for that. But when you look at it, you realize that they have some important limitation. I mean, usual example is, you know, people often say that I predicted something, nobody else did. I predicted and it came true. It's like somebody predicting that there will be economic recession, whereas everybody was expecting growth, and they say, I proved right. Well, maybe they were right. However, what we don't hear is 9 out of 10 times they were wrong, and they're not thinking about that. They're not talking about it. So that's where our bias perception comes into play. We remember the thing that we did right, and that's why we are wise, but we don't remember the numerous times that we did things that were wrong and showed that we were not quite wise.
Several years ago, it became a motto in my life. A new motto in my life became, don't be so sure, because so many things that I was banking on, just thought were rock solid, steady, turned out not to be. And Ellen Langer, who is a world famous psychologist, also one of the most cited authors on the planet, she said on this show, on this podcast, that the correct answer to any question is, it depends. It just depends on so much. And I think I've come to learn the hard way that that's very true. So lesson number one, if you think you're wise, you're not. Lesson number two, now this was a ray of sunshine into my life. Anyone and everyone can become wiser.
Yes, that's really true. Wisdom is modifiable. Unlike IQ, IQ is hard to change, but wisdom can be changed. It can be increased in anyone. You know, I was thinking that in high school, you know, there are the yearbooks that we keep, and we predict that one who is most likely to succeed, least likely to succeed. If you follow these people a few decades later, you often find that what was written was not always right, that the prediction didn't come true. And often the least expected people did very well. You know, there are examples of college dropouts who went on to become business wizards and billionaires, and Steve Jobs and, you know, Ted Turner and Bill Gates and so on. And there are also some convicted criminals who later on became heroes, that after they got out of the jail, they totally changed themselves. So they went from being totally antisocial to being very pro-social. They learned in the process, and they have become really the community heroes. So that kind of a radical change, normally we won't expect, that does take place. And that's the inspiring thing I find, that so the lesson, related lesson, is don't give up on anybody. That mind is a terrible thing to waste. So even when you think that somebody is not going to do well, be prepared for surprise. So sometimes I see children who are so shy, so self-effacing, and they want to stay out of the glare, and they don't want to talk to other people. And we don't know how they're going to do when they grow up to be adults. And yet, they grow up and they become great speakers, for example, the great leader. So we should never forget that anybody and everybody can become wiser.
And you make the point in your book that this is not a function of intelligence. We're not talking about crystallized intelligence or just being smart. Wisdom is much more complex than that.
Yes, wisdom is much more than intelligence. Wisdom is a personality trait. However, it has different components. And the most important component is pro-social behavior, things that we do for others than for ourselves. Empathy, compassion, altruism. Second component is self-reflection, ability to look inwards and try to understand ourselves. Another is emotional regulation, control over emotion. I mean, we still have emotions, but not let them go to the extremes. One thing which is rare these days is acceptance of diverse perspectives, that we can disagree with somebody, but we can respect that person for having a different opinion. At the same time, we have to be decisive when we need to be. And finally, spirituality. Now, that's somewhat controversial component of wisdom. Not everybody agrees with that. However, spirituality means connectedness with something that is always there. You may not see it, whether you call it nature, consciousness, or God, but you feel connected, and that's why you don't feel lonely. So these are the components of wisdom, which are different from just intelligence.
I'm taking notes as we speak here, so I'm learning on the job. Excellent. Okay, lesson number three is also a very big boost for me. I'm born and raised in the U.S. I've lived in Australia for 40 years, most of my life. But when I open my mouth, people think I'm a tourist, you know? So lesson number three from you is don't give up your accent.
Yes. So I'm proud to say that I became president of the American Psychiatric Association in 2012. And I was the first Asian American president. This is an organization that is more than 175 years old, largest organization of psychiatrists. And yet, there were no Asian American psychiatrists, although there are many of them currently today. And so in my presidential address, I began by saying that I was born and raised in India and I moved to the US. And I didn't have too many financial resources or connections in this country. But I had three resources that I brought with me or that came with me. First is my wife. Second is my love for psychiatry. And third, my Indian accent. And I said that I'm happy to report that none of them has deserted me to date. And people actually remember that and they remind me that I said that. But it's actually, I've been thinking about this because accent is something we don't talk about. We talk about racial and ethnic differences and regional differences, religious differences. But accent actually plays a role. And it plays a negative role also. Actually, often it plays more negative role than positive role. There is a bias against people with accent. And part of that is justified. I mean, I do see that. For example, if people can't understand what I'm saying, then they have a reason to not want to hear me. And when I first came to US, actually, I had a very heavy accent and people had difficulty in understanding me. And I couldn't understand why they couldn't understand me. It's only with time I realized that. And I felt for them. And the reason actually my accent was heavy because I didn't learn ABC until seventh grade. I didn't go to English medium school. I went to school that taught my language. And I lived in India for 20 plus years. So by the time I came to the US, I was there for such a long time and my English was very accented. And yet actually I love languages. I write very well English, but speaking, so actually I came to appreciate and empathize people's difficulty in understanding the accent. And sometimes I wonder if I should have taken some lessons to reduce my accent as some people do. And actually, I think there's nothing wrong with that. But at the same time, I think it is probably good to have that because it becomes useful for other people who are like me, that they can still retain their culture. In a way, accent is a representation of the culture. And there's nothing wrong in having still my culture while I'm totally Americanized now. But that doesn't mean that I don't have the Indian background and I should disown that. The US is often called a melting pot. I don't think that's the right analogy. I consider it more as a salad bowl, that it is one thing, it is one salad, no question about that. But different elements have their own uniqueness. They bring something unique. And I think to that extent, the accent is useful in showing that.
Very true. My personal experience is very true. My wife is Brazilian, and when she travels to, would travel to the US or to Australia, and people from different countries see the world differently than you. And I find that so enriching. Now, this next one, it must be a misprint, something I must have miscopied. Spend some time with people you dislike. Why the hell would I want to spend more time with people I dislike?
You know, that's a really good question. And you know what happens in today's world, especially, there is so much polarization. Mm. And of course, we know at the political level, the right and left. So people watch either Fox or MSNBC. There is nothing in between for most people. Not only that, but if somebody does both, that is considered a weakness in that person by people on that side. And so this kind of acceptance of diverse perspectives, instead of being lauded, is criticized as being something bad. That doesn't mean someone doesn't have the principles. And I think that is so wrong because things change. I mean, in sports, actually, it's an interesting thing. But so I was in Washington, D.C. for a number of years and was a big Redskins fan. And some of my friends actually moved to Dallas. And so Dallas
Uh-oh.
Cowboys.
Uh-oh.
That's exactly right. That's in Washington, Dallas is the enemy and Dallas, Washington is the enemy, football-wise. And so how do you switch loyalty? And people are so loyal. I mean, it is sometimes it goes to a gross extent when you see the player from the opposite side hurt and people are happy in their mind, which is so bad. And yeah. So that kind of extreme loyalty, the problem is you're forced to change it. So you may as well do that before you're forced to do that. I really think it is necessary to have understanding and appreciation of opposing views. So in terms of empathy, understanding, so there are two types of empathy. One is cognitive, one is affective. Cognitive means just understanding somebody's rationale. Mm-hmm. Affective means feeling or sharing that emotion. And sharing that emotion may not always be easy, but at least understanding the rationale, I think, is really critical. That's why I loved school debates that you have, you know, the two sides on the opposite. And especially when you're given the side at the last moment and you say, this is the topic of debate and you have to speak on that, because that really trains your mind to think about both sides. Similarly, in science, actually, debates are very common and they should be common. I mean, that's how science advances. I have some strong opinion and somebody has to say that, no, that's wrong. So I think understanding that is useful for ourselves because our mind broadens. But also we have to keep in mind that sometime later, we may not have a choice but to adapt that position. So you may as well start learning that from the beginning. And best way to do that is actually spending some time with people who think differently, people you dislike. And there's no reason to necessarily to dislike them. We don't have to like them. We don't have to love them, but we can respect them. So I think mutual respect is critical for one's own growth.
Let me ask you about that. That's a very real problem nowadays, I think, in the U.S. And also with me, even though I don't live in the U.S. anymore, I consider myself to be a broad-minded, well-educated. I got a high school diploma and everything and traveled around old enough to know better. But there are some people on the other political party that I just cannot stand. And that's okay. But I have found myself lumping them all together and now just wanting to physically avoid them online and in person. And I say to myself, this is not the goes back to your first point. If I thought I was wise, now I know I'm not. And, you know, I'm not proud of this, but, and I think, well, how do I counter this when I have this visceral reaction against not only what they believe, but how they behave?
I think we need to find the right people on the other side to debate. I think I agree with you 100% that there are people on the opposite side who don't want to listen to the other side at all. And they are so firmly believers in their own thinking, that may not be worth talking to them. But I'm saying that there are people who can have a different opinion. I mean, in a way, it is like the Supreme Court. I mean, US Supreme Court, there are conservative justices and liberal justices, and they disagree vehemently when they write it. I mean, they have to, obviously. And they come up with something. So you're right. We need people on the other side who are like us. And this, and there has to be opening for debate on both sides. Otherwise, it won't work. There are people like that. And again, because of being perceived as a weakness, people don't come out and say sometimes that, yes, they agree with both the sides. So that's where the trick lies. So that's why I think probably what needs to happen is we need to grow that group.
Let's move to lesson number 5. Controlled pessimism is better than uncontrolled optimism.
So again, I'm a big sports fan, and so that's a good analogy that I can give. So I'm a football fan. So in San Diego, I became a Chargers fan. And we bought season tickets and found out that the Chargers had a great knack of losing game at the last 5 minutes. And they were time and again, when they were winning, I mean, something they would do, something, some gap, something like that. And it became really hard. And so my daughter is also a big football fan. And then, so we used to go, and then we would talk about that. And then I said, I must do something. But I like watching football, but I don't come out feeling angry, depressed, anxious. That's not good. So I decided, so next year, so when I started going to the game, I expected that Chargers will lose. So with that expectation, I could never lose, because if they lose, that's of course what I expected. But if they won, gosh, I mean, this is fantastic, amazing, etc. So what I was doing was actually I had a controlled pessimism about Chargers. But there's an important thing to stress here is that this is pessimism about things over which we have no control. I don't want to be pessimistic about things I have control over. For example, if I'm preparing for an exam, I need to be optimistic that I will study hard and then I will pass the exam. But once the exam is over, then I don't know what is going to happen. Then I have no control over that. So then I start thinking that, you know, if things don't work out, I may not pass, or I may not get good grades. And then when I get grades and if they're good, then I'm really happy. But so that is an important thing to remember, that things over which we have control, we must be optimistic. Again, realistically optimistic, not stupidly optimistic or over-optimistic, right? But we should be optimistic. But things over which we have no control, it doesn't help to be optimistic. I mean, I have no control over the weather. I don't know control over how different countries are going to react to a crisis, so on and so forth. I know control over what the election results are, et cetera, et cetera, right? So I like Kenny Rogers' this song about gambler.
The gambler.
Yes. And there's one line there where he says, every hand is a winner and every hand is a loser. And that's what happens actually in life, that anything we get into we can succeed or we may not succeed. So being too optimistic doesn't help. Being too pessimistic, obviously, is not a good idea. But if we keep that things under our control or not under our control, I think that makes for happiness.
Well, and I think optimism should be defined. Let's clarify. Optimism is not a psychotic break from reality, which is, we know, you see some people who just, now, I suppose all sports fans suffer from this by definition, including me, but that's okay, because it doesn't really matter. And I remember watching a football game in Sydney, evidently I was yelling at the television, and my friend said, you know, they can't hear you. And I said, you know, what makes you so sure about that? Anyway, but that's just part of being a sports fan, and it's fun, and it's not that serious. But your distinction, I think, is very good between you be optimistic about the things over which you have some control and pessimistic about, reasonably pessimistic about the things over which you have no control.
I mean, talking about sports and TV along that line. So my wife is a big fan of Duke basketball. Our daughter went there. And then, so she has a belief that when she's watching the game, Duke starts losing. So she would rather not watch the game. And so that makes her feel good, actually, that she can. But really, I mean, obviously, she has no control over what happened. But that's, again, an example of how our behavior is affected by our perceived. But your point is well taken that optimism is not unbridled optimism. Optimism just means more positive attitude.
Your session with your wife and your daughter remind me of, we were in Sydney, and every time my wife sat down to watch Australian rules football with the Sydney Swans, they won, and they ended up playing in the grand final that year. So every time they come on, I say, honey, the game's starting. So got to get that good karma happening.
Yes.
All right. Lesson number 6. Oneliness is good. Loneliness is not.
Yes. So this is something I read, I think about a year ago or so. Faye Alberti, she's a British historian. And she said that the word loneliness did not exist in English language until 1800.
Huh.
Yes. The word that existed was oneliness. So that is loneliness without the L. It was not just absence of L. It had different connotation. Oneliness meant being by yourself, but being happy, being contented. You can do a bunch of different things when you are by yourself. And you can be creative. You can have fun of your own. You can relax. You can explore new things. Loneliness, on the other hand, is when you are alone, you feel distressed. That distress is a critical component of loneliness. So you are alone, but you are severely distressed. And so loneliness has been increasing since 1800. So why? Because she thinks that it is industrial revolution, which sort of made the family smaller, the movements increase, the competition increase, more divorces, and so on and so forth. I personally think that loneliness has increased in the last 20 to 30 years a lot because of globalization and very rapid rise of technology. But it is known actually that loneliness has doubled in the last few decades. And loneliness is really bad in the sense numerous scientific studies have shown that loneliness is a major risk factor for heart disease, diabetes, major depression, Alzheimer's disease, and other dementias. Loneliness is as bad to health and longevity as smoking and obesity. So loneliness is really something that is a major problem, but it doesn't mean being alone. Being alone can make you happy if you have that positive solitude. So that's why loneliness is good, loneliness is bad, but it also means there's something you can do for that. And the cure for loneliness is not having 100 different friends. It actually reflects on the quality of your relationship. So you may have, say, 2 friends, and I have 5 friends. So I should be less lonely than you are. But in reality, I may be more lonely because my 5 relationships are not close, whereas your 2 relationships are really close and deep. So that is what is needed, is close relationships. And if you have that kind of a security, you are happy when you are by yourself. You can do something. If you feel insecure, then you need to be with others. If you feel secure, you don't need that.
That reminds me of a quotation by Alfred North Whitehead, a mathematician philosopher from last century. He said, religion is what one does with one's solitariness. And that reminded me of your word, oneliness. It's not being alone that is the problem necessarily. It's what you do with it. And religion is a practice. And actually, it reminded me of what you were saying earlier about spirituality, that sense of connectedness. The very word religion is like ligament. It connects, it binds, it ties you to something, and something larger than yourself, usually. So there is sort of a theme developing here, at least in my mind, about, well, as you just said, Loneliness is good. Loneliness is not.
Right. Right. Exactly right. I think it is a sense of being connected. And so in religion, you are connected with the God that you believe in. In spirituality, it doesn't have to be God. It can be nature, consciousness, souls, whatever, some abstract construct. But you feel connected. And that's why you're never lonely.
And that's the key. It's the feeling connected. And this goes back to, well, you will know this, but going back to people you disagree with, people you dislike. What everyone wants, what everyone needs is to feel understood, not just be understood, not intellectually, cognitively, but to feel understood. Once you have that connection with a person, which is invaluable, then there is room for debate, progress, synergy, whatever you're trying to accomplish. Lesson number 7, finding your fault is harder than finding their fault. Ain't that the truth?
I like Michael Jackson's song, The Man in the Mirror. He says that I'm starting with the man in the mirror. I'm asking him to change his ways. And that's really the crux in a way. When something goes wrong, it's easy to blame somebody or blame the surroundings or the environment, the circumstances. And that gives satisfaction that it's not my fault, it happened, and et cetera. So that is useful in shorter run, but it's actually harmful in the longer run, because if I'm making some mistake and that is creating problems, I need to find out what the problem is on my side, because that is something I can control. But it needs self-reflection, and honest self-reflection. That is the thing. Sometimes we are not honest to ourselves. I mean, we may not be honest to others because we want to come across as having all the perfect virtues in the world, but we got to be honest to ourselves. Because by cheating ourselves, who are we helping? Nobody, right? And of course, it's not that easy, because sometimes just if we keep on defending ourselves to others, we start believing that. And that's really unhelpful. I mean, so as a scientist, for example, I mean, I write papers and grants, and sometimes the paper is rejected or grant is not funded. It is very easy. And that's a common reaction, actually. You blame the reviewers. Oh, the reviewers didn't understand what I was saying. It was so clear. And how did they not understand? Well, if it was that clear, they would have understood it. So there is something that maybe you didn't make it clear, I didn't make it clear, and so on. So if I keep on blaming them, I'm not going to go anywhere. The paper will never be published and grant will never be funded. I had to accept that I did something that didn't come across right. Or it maybe it's not that my idea was wrong, but I didn't present it correctly. So how do I improve it? How do I do something better? So one of the things I learned, again, as a scientist, so now when I write a grant and I present it to my group, I begin by saying that don't tell me what is right about this grant. Don't tell me how great it is. I want to hear what is wrong with it. And the more you tell me, the better it is for me, because then I can correct it. So when I submit it, it's going to be so much better. And that's what we need to do for ourselves, that when we are undertaking an action or something like that, think about where we can go wrong and how we can prevent that.
You are so right. Facing reality unflinchingly is difficult, and it takes courage. And in my experience, it takes practice. My summation, my version of that lesson is 5 words. This is psychotherapy in 5 words. Just tell yourself the truth. You don't have to tell me. You don't have to tell anybody. And you can even do it looking in a mirror. Say it aloud. Just tell yourself the truth. And the only truth you'll ever really know is how you feel about something at any particular moment. Start with that, and that will just lead you to the next. And you'd be surprised how many problems get resolved very quickly if you just tell yourself the truth.
Right, right, right. No, that's exactly right. And so one thing I suggest for self-reflection is people usually say they're so busy, they have no time to sit down and think about anything. Well, you can make time for it when you need to. So one should be very self-disciplined. You know, just like we need to be self-disciplined in terms of physical exercise, right? So we need to set aside, say, half an hour, 2-3 times a week, say, during breakfast or before going to bed or while doing exercise, where we just think about what stressed us out or what made us happy during the last 2-3 days. Just think about that event that made us happy and event that stressed us out. If we do that over a period of days, we'll find there is a common pattern that emerges, that there are some things that bother us and something that make us happy. What are they? And what is the underlying thing? Forget about the person and the situation. We are the common element, right? So that helps actually get better understanding of ourselves and our limitations as well as strengths.
And what you're describing, it just isn't that hard. It just isn't that difficult. The psychologist Jamie Pennebaker said on this show, he's the founder of Expressive Writing, and he said, you can do it 2 minutes, as little as 2 minutes a day for four consecutive days. And originally it was 20 minutes, and then they've done studies with 15 minutes. And he says to me on the show, 2 minutes a day has been proven to be effective. And, you know, you can't tell me you can't find 2 minutes to self-reflect. But it does take a bit of courage, motivation, and willingness to uncover what your self-reflection reveals, I suppose.
Right. No, exactly. And self-discipline. I mean, this is because it's always easy to find excuses why one couldn't do it. But that's not going to help.
That's the bottom line. It won't help. But what you're describing, what we're talking about, will help.
Right.
All right. Lesson number eight. This may be my problem. Lesson number eight. Too much of a virtue can be bad. Is that it? Am I just too virtuous for this world? Is that what it comes down to?
Well, the example, actually, the serious example is compassion. I mean, it's good to be compassionate. Too much compassion is not good. And I often remember, you know, when we are flying, you know, the plane takes off, the security video comes on. And the security video says that if the air pressure falls, masks will come down. Put on your own mask first before helping those near you. And so I'm in the middle of it. There's a child on one side, disabled person on the other side. And I can say, I mean, I should be compassionate. I should help them before I help myself. Bad idea. Because it will take only 5 seconds for me to put on my mask and then I can help them. But if I did them, then actually in the process, I will suffocate and then I won't be able to help anybody else. So that principle is really important, that we need to take care of ourselves while we are taking care of others. It is like caregivers of people with Alzheimer's, cancer. It's very difficult life they live. They provide so much care, but they have to care for themselves. They must care for themselves in order to be useful for their care recipient. And if you don't take care of yourself, you can't take care of others. And I often find people, I mean, among physicians, among priests, and various other professionals, that some people who are very compassionate toward others, they're harsh on themselves. And that's not good, because if you constantly feel guilty about what you have not done, regret your mistakes, you're not going to be useful to others. So you need to be self-compassionate, of course, not too much self-compassionate, because then it becomes narcissism, that everything you do is right. And so that's not good. But every component of wisdom that I mentioned, I can tell you how it can be bad if it is too much. For example, let's say self-reflection is good, right? We talk about that. But say if somebody is constantly self-preoccupied, spend all the time analyzing his own behavior, that's not good. That's really, sometimes that's a part of obsessive-compulsive disorder, OCD, right? So that's not good. Emotional regulation is good. But say somebody is so regulated emotionally that doesn't show any emotion. Say the person becomes like a zombie or a robot. They're not a real wise person, right? So, decisiveness. Again, if you are very quickly decisive, you'll make wrong decisions. On the other hand, if you procrastinate all the time, that's not good either. So the balance is the main thing. And so one of my favorites is actually the Serenity Prayer, you know, give me the courage to change the things I can, serenity to accept the things I cannot, and wisdom to know the difference. So anything has to be in balance.
Well, which takes us to the ninth lesson, which is very Zen. You will have to unpack this for me. Okay, lesson number nine, balance.
Yes.
Feel sad when happy, feel happy when sad. What?
Yes, I know. So I can give an example of a friend. So this is a couple, we have known them from medical school. So very long time friends, very close friends. And the husband and wife are different in their personalities. The husband is more pessimistic. The wife is more optimistic. So after we moved to the States, the first time you, and subsequently also when you go back to India, when you're going there, you're really excited, happy to see your family, friends. You haven't seen them in a long time. And coming back, you're feeling sad. I mean, that, you know, that again, you won't see them for a long time. So the husband, he said that when they were going to India, he always thought about the return flight. And he felt bad that, you know, that I'm just going to be there for a few weeks and then I come back and it'll be all sad. And the wife said, actually, on the way back, she always thinks about the next trip to India. And so in a way, a person should be a combination of the two, that we should think about both times. So when I'm going to India, I feel happy, but I also have to keep in mind that I'm going to be there only for a few weeks, then I come back. And likewise, when I come back, I'm sad, but I know that I will be going back in a few years. Just as an example of how things change. Part of the reason is that the short-term and long-term consequences of anything are very different. So what is good today may be bad tomorrow, good again the next day. And so there is this fable of a small village in which there was a farmer and his family, and they had a cow. And the cow was very important for the family, for farming, etc. One day the cow died. And it was a disaster. It was a disaster for the family. I mean, how would they survive and so on? And so it's so bad. But the villagers got together and they said, oh, look at this poor farmer. He lies up. We will buy him two cows. So they bought two cows for him. And he was very happy that actually that it was good, that actually that we got two cows, and which we never would have gotten. They were very happy. So then they had to actually domesticate the cow. And while domesticating, a son fell and broke his leg. So they said, oh, this is bad. This is really, the whole thing is so bad. And then a few months later, there was a draft and they recruited everybody into the military except for him because he had a broken leg. So they were happy that he's dead. So point, you get the point, that what is good is bad, is good is bad. So when we feel happy, we have to remember that things may not stay happy for long. They will change. And you will become sad. But when you're sad, again, things will go back to being happy some point and you will feel happy. So it is important to have that both the emotions to some extent all the times.
It's very stoic what you're describing. They were very big on reframing your current event, whatever the current event was, and remembering both the positive and the negative components of it, that this too shall pass, whether it's good or bad, that change is coming, get ready, because here it comes, you know, it's going to, whatever your situation is, it's going to alter or reverse, or, and that is life, and you need to learn how to ride that out.
Right, exactly.
Okay.
And that actually, that protects us from extreme sadness, because we are expecting that. It protects us from being too relaxed, too lenient, and not expecting that something could go wrong, and to prepare for that. So it is important, again, in sports, again, for example, good coaches do that. Even when the team is leading by so many points at halftime, they know that the other team will come back. And so you expect the opposite of what is happening. And so that's critical for success.
Is that resilience? Is that what we're describing?
No doubt, it is partly resilience. But it's also anticipation. And so resilience, typically resilience is described as response to a stress, that you get over it. But here, even before the stress occurs, you're anticipating it. So in a way, I mean, you're right, in the sense it is sort of proactive resilience, if you will.
Proactive resilience. Okay, we'll go with that. lesson number 10. Okay, I think I've got this one down, Pat Dillip. Lesson number 10, act old when young, act young when old, because I've been immature my whole life. So I think I've got that one.
Yes. So personally, I mean, I think this is true. This is not bragging about myself, but when I was a teenager, I couldn't understand why these other teenagers were constantly complaining about the adults, what they were not getting. And I said, there's so much to do. They couldn't read books. There are so many opportunities. Why are they wasting this time in this, just complaining about things that is not going to help? As I'm getting older, Actually, I don't like to spend time with other older people who are constantly complaining about their physical ailments and then how there is ageism and they can't do anything. I mean, I like to work with younger people because there is some energy, vitality, learning new things, and that makes me energized. So instead of spending time with people who are depressed and anxious, you know, sad, I want that energy because that comes to me. And so I really believe that we should have generations have complementary strengths. Younger age is associated with, of course, youth, physical health, but also processing speed and being able to learn new things and so on. Whereas older age is associated with wisdom, as we saw, but not, we slow down with age. Ability to learn very new things goes down. So we lose something, but we gain something. And that's why one thing that I stress in all my work is intergenerational activities are critical for mm-hmm. the society. They're complementary strengths. And in a way, this intergenerational activity should also be in one's own mind. That we should have, you know, just like we have right brain and left brain, we should have young brain and an old brain, in a sense of their assets, which will be very helpful.
Intergenerational, you mean one generation playing with the children or the grandchildren or different ages interacting like one big community, or I'm thinking of like a church or a social club, or for me, I mean, I'm thinking of the guys I play basketball with or used to play basketball when I was back in Sydney. We have guys show up with, I've seen guys get married, have children. Those children grow up and I end up chasing them on the basketball court. And I just think this is just the best thing. And the fathers are playing with their kids in a basketball game and in an intense, serious basketball game. I just think that's wonderful.
I agree 100%. That is absolutely wonderful. I mean, it is great. And I remember I used to play tennis when younger. So I used to teach my daughters, you know, in the beginning. And slowly they got better and better. And finally, my job was to be a ball boy or a cheerleader. And, but that was so pleasing. That was so great to see them play so well. And then in the meantime, of course, we played with each other. And it was fun. And there was no loser then for me. That, you know, if I won, that's great. But if I lost, that's great. I lost to my daughter. And So exactly these intergenerational activities, but they also go from grandparents to grandchildren. I think that also is really important because in the work on wisdom, there's something I stress is that our society, modern Western society, devalues the usefulness of older people for children. We need older people, and there is actually even evolutionary basis, something I call grandmother hypothesis of wisdom. I mean, I don't know, this is actually a well-known phenomenon. Whereas the older people help the younger generations be happier, live longer, be more fertile. And when older people are involved in raising younger children, they have far fewer problems because there is almost transmission of wisdom, transmission of culture from one generation to another. So
in your book, you cited evidence of that in different cultures, different times, different. And I remember that because it had never occurred to me. The simple presence and interaction of grandparents, specifically grandmothers, had a very salubrious, a palliative effect on the entire society or social band or whatever group we're talking about. And I was quite amazed by that. And I don't know why I was amazed. I just was. I just never even thought about it.
Yeah, yeah. Now, there actually is solid research that totally supports that. And it is mutually beneficial. So if the older people and younger people, there's the one study done called Experience Score, where they had older people who had retired from their jobs over 65. They had to agree to spend at least 15 hours a week in an elementary school in downtown. And so these are kids who don't have grandparents, sometimes not even functioning parents. So when these older adults spend time with them after the 1 year, the kids did very well, of course. Their grades went through the roof. They were happy. Importantly, the older people became not only happier, physical health improved, their biomarkers of stress and aging improved, and their hippocampus did not decline. It did not shrink, unlike the control group. It's really mind-boggling.
Yeah, let's just go over that. The hippocampus part of the brain did not shrink as it normally, I would have thought, inevitably does in these older people. So the payoff to acting and participating in these intergenerative activities, payoff is for me. For me, the more I do it, I'm the beneficiary.
Right. I mean, they are also beneficiaries. No question about that.
Yeah, them too.
The kids, of course. Right. But that's the nice thing. It is mutually beneficial. I think, again, in the modern society, there is often a tendency to pit one generation against another, saying that if we spend money on older people, we don't have enough money to spend on children. That's so wrong. Actually, what we need, intergenerational activities, because they both help both the generations. So you're absolutely right. That's what is needed.
Well, let me finish up by asking you one last question. We've been talking about wisdom, things that you've learned. Let me ask you about, what have you unlearned lately? Something you absolutely positively knew to be true then, but now know it's just not the case.
So as a scientist in the beginning for years, I avoided the media, general media, because of the concern that they would misinterpret. And then they would have their own biases and they would present along that line. It doesn't matter what you say. They would write whatever they wanted to. And I have found that's actually not the case. Again, there are some bad apples everywhere. But by and large, actually, they are reasonable. I may disagree with them. However, they do a good job of representing you. And if I was misrepresented, it could be because I didn't present myself well. And so I became much more empathic about them. That their job is to publish something that is newsworthy, because they are competing with other people. So they need to have some story that is publishable, that is exciting, that is surprising. I understand that. So I need to tell my story in a way that will make it publishable for them. And because they ultimately, most of them, their job is to educate the public, or at least steer the public in one direction, or at least let them know whatever it is. And again, when we talk about some major media, I think most reporters are, the reports are pretty balanced. So I realize increasingly that actually I need to work with them. They are helpful. And here, so in terms of learning and unlearning, what I'm describing to you is my impression about a whole group of people was wrong, because I was projecting onto them what I heard from other people. But I myself didn't experience that. So I based on that. But my experience actually showed that that is not the case. So one needs to be open-minded about judging another constituency or another group of people, that we should not assume or we should not inherit the prejudices from our colleagues, but the colleagues may be wrong. So it is useful to give a chance, work with people and see what you get.
The key to that, I think, as I hear you, is that you were empathetic towards them. You took the effort to appreciate, to try and understand, what is it they need? What is it they want? What is their job? How can you help them do their job better, look better, meet them halfway? And understanding that seemed to dissipate all the potential anxiety that was lurking in there, not based on fact, not based on your experience.
That's exactly right. And, I have had a similar experience when I was running for the APA presidency. So it's a national election, of course, among the members of the APA and the largest psychiatric organization, something 40,000 members and so on. And when I decided to run, actually, many people said that most of the members are clinicians. And they said, you are a researcher. And so, people won't relate to you. And you won't relate to them because you are living on an ivory tower of research. And this is not the everyday practice that you are concerned with. Another thing they told me was, when you talk to an audience, they're not interested so much in learning about you, what you do. They're interested in learning about what you think about them and how you are going to help them. That is what they want to hear. And just like we are talking about the media, that approach that I am here to understand what you want, and I'm going to try to meet those needs. Then I want you to meet my needs, which is to work for me or whatever, to write something, etc. And that really was very helpful, that you need to give something to others before you expect them to give something to you. And it just starts with empathy. You just create their emotions and they get yours.
It starts with empathy. And we'll finish on that note here today. Folks, you've been listening to the podcast, 10 Lessons That Took Me 50 Years to Learn. Our guest today has been Dr. Dilip Jess, author of Wiser, The Scientific Roots of Wisdom. You've been listening to us, so we'd like to hear from you. You can contact us. You can email us, podcast@10lessonslearned.com. That's podcast at 10, the number 10, lessonslearned.com. We'd love to hear from you. This episode is produced by Robert Hosrey and is supported, as always, by Professional Development Forum, PDF, professionaldevelopmentforum.org. They supply webinars, social media discussions, podcast parties, anything you want, everything you need to accelerate your performance in the modern workplace. And while you're at it, go ahead and hit that subscribe button, because you don't want to miss an episode of this podcast. And this podcast is the one that makes the world a wiser place, lesson by lesson. Thanks for listening.